Okay.
Yeah,
We're
Mikhail
gonna get
and
that.
I have had that happen where we actually have people crash in. And the only way that seems to be able to avoid it is to mute everybody initially, and then open them up after a few minutes, because that it seems like when it happens, it always happens in the beginning. But anyway, hello everyone, and welcome to this 51st webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress as shown here. Previous episodes of this webinar, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. They're always listed in the upper left-hand corner here. All the webinars that are in progress are listed here, including, for instance, here we have Duane Carpenter's Awakening of the Higher Mind is also listed. All right. Okay, we began last session with a look at the altars, mounds, stone circles, temples that were dedicated to the sun in ancient times. These are all just examples of buildings that were built to specifically to worship the sun. We then began the section entitled The Solar Trinity, where we learned that in pretty much all ancient cultures, the sun was symbolic of the supreme authority of the creator, a belief carried forward to modern times through both Hinduism and theosophy. We then explored various spiritual trinities, including the Hindu Trimurti of Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma, ancient Egypt's Osiris, Isis, and Horus, the Greek monad, dyad or nous, and triad or soul, and the Christian Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, all of which are personifications of the three logoi of theosophy. You can see them up here. MPH then focuses on the three aspects of the sun in ancient Egypt, whose journey through the heavens was depicted as taking place on the solar bark. We then review the precession of the equinoxes, which S.A. Mackey, among others, believes to be represented by the zodiac of Dendera, shown here at left, and here an actual photo. We then learned that solar fire was believed to be the essence of all the gods of antiquity, a fact recognized by Egyptian priests who wore lion and leopard skins in recognition of the all-pervasive solar energy. And again, this is another belief that has been that is held by theosophists, and it believes that all the energy of this solar system is a reflection of the basic energy of the solar logos. MPH then turns to the Egyptian system of decans and their rulerships by the gods, which are strangely broken into different periods. You'll have like a 2 week and a 1 week period, or two and a 2 week period. Makes for a very different system connected with the signs. I see a hand already.
Yeah, go ahead, please, James.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I remember seeing that last time and wondering why there was 10 days and then 20 days. That didn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't make sense, does it? Well, you know, you would have to go pretty deeply. I can't really answer your question. You'd have to go really deeply into the priestcraft of ancient Egypt. The question would be whether that knowledge is even available to us. It has a lot to do with the nature of their decans. You know, decanates are the decanates. There's three decanates with each sign.
Right, 10 degrees.
That's right, yeah, as you know. And even today, we recognize decanate rulers. D.K. Talks about them in his book on esoteric astrology. My guess, if I was going to forward a guess, would be that the decanate rulers take precedence over the rulers of the sign, and therefore the sign ruler then is determined by the decanate rulers, as described here. That's just, it seems to me that's probably what's going on.
So it'd be like twice, counted twice.
Yeah, well, you know, they wouldn't even have had our idea of 12 consecutive signs. That wouldn't have even been the concept they were working from. It would have been, you know, this splintered method of rulership, you know, because it wasn't derived out of a 12 consecutive astrological signs as our system is. But okay. I'm not an Egyptologist, and I wouldn't be able to really give you more insight into just why that's the case. There may be writings on this. You know, you could do a deeper dive into that. But
that's okay. I just wanted to see if you happen to know off the top of your head. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think there is something to what I said about the fact that the decanate rulers take precedence over the sign rulers, you know, and that therefore the signs were fragmented. And it, you know, if you were to look into our decanate rulers, you would see that if we gave precedence to them, you would have the same kind of fragmentation as the Egyptians had, you know. I'm not going to get into it, but the, you know, the decanate rulers reflect each, you know, like if you have in the fire, if you're in a fire sign, then the second decanate ruler is determined by the next fire sign in line, and the third decanate ruler is determined by the third fire sign from the one you're in. So, you know, if we gave precedence to the decadent rulers, then we would have a fragmented zodiac in very much the same way. And I think that's just how they derived it. Okay, anyway. What next word? Right. Let me find where I was. Sorry, guys. Okay. So next we looked at two illustrations. The first entitled The Sun Rising Over the Back of the Lion, an ancient symbol found even today in the Iranian flag. This is the Persian flag of not too many centuries back. The illustration at the bottom of the page represents the winged globe found in temples throughout Egypt, which is just, you know, I've been to Egypt. This image is everywhere, overhead, serving as a lintel. And it's just one example of the ubiquitous influence of Egyptian solar worship. Some of the others are shown in this chart, which we looked at last time, showing how all these deities that you see over here on the left, and many, many more, one could argue that there isn't any deities that can't be, or weren't, I should say, combined with the influence of the sun. And then you see here the what that deity then becomes as a result of its connection with the sun, right? Very different way of recognizing the concept of deity. It quite a bit more esoteric, actually, because you see these gods then as energetic aspects and not so much as anthropological beings, you know. Okay, we ended last session by taking a look at crowns and scepters, both symbols of reception and dispensation of solar energy. And this takes us up to where we left off. So we'll start today with a list of gods and sons of gods who represent some aspect of solar fire, of solar energy. So can we get a reader, please?
Okay. I'm going to be an intrepid reader, so please forgive any murdering I do to some of these, okay?
Well, if you just pause, like for instance, when we get to Tezcatlipoca, if you just pause, I'll say the word, if that helps. Or
yes,
if you
thank
want to,
you.
If you want to, just take a shot at it, whichever you want.
Okay. Many deities have been associated with the sun. The Greeks believed that Apollo, Bacchus, Dionysus, Sebasius, Hercules, Jason, Ulysses, Zeus, Uranus, and Vulcan partook of either the visible or invisible attributes of the sun. The Norwegians regarded Balder, the beautiful, as the solar deity, and Odin, I said that wrong, say it right, Francis.
Odin. I only learned that in our section on Odin, but yeah, Odin.
Okay.
I think we had a Norwegian that actually gave us the right pronunciation.
Okay. Is often connected with the celestial orb, especially because of his one eye. Among the Egyptians, Osiris, Ra, Anubis, Hermes, and even the mysterious Amun himself had points of resemblance with the solar disk. Isis was the mother of the sun, and even Typhon, the destroyer, was supposed to be the form of solar energy. The Egyptian sun myth finally centered around the person of a mysterious deity called Serapis. The two Central American deities,
Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl.
Thank you. While often associated with the winds, were also undoubtedly solar gods. In masonry, the sun has many symbols. One expression of the solar energy is Solomon, whose name, Sol Om An, is the name for the supreme light in the three different languages. Hiram of the Chaldees, is also a solar deity, and the story of his attack and murder by the ruffians with its solar interpretation will be found in the chapter The Hiramic Legend. A striking example of the important part which the sun plays in the symbols and rituals of Freemasonry is given by George Oliver D.D. in his Dictionary of Symbolic Masonry as follows.
Okay. So first up, many deities have been associated with the sun. The Greeks believed that Apollo, Bacchus, Dionysus, Sebasius, Hercules, Jason, Ulysses, Zeus, Uranus, and Vulcan partook of either the visible or invisible attributes of the sun. Okay, so we'll do some of these. We'll just take a look at some of these. Apollo is the fire of life intrinsic to the sun, as well as the god of oracular wisdom. And Hercules was considered to be his archetypal disciple. In fact, DK says Castor and Pollux were also called Apollo and Hercules. Apollo meaning the ruler, the sun god, and Hercules, the one who comes to labor. They represent, therefore, the two aspects of man's nature, the soul and the personality. The spiritual man and the human being through which that spiritual entity is functioning. Christ incarnate in matter, that would be Apollo, and God working through form. Okay. Bacchus, Dionysus, and Sabazius were all gods of vegetation, fertility, and wine, whose acolytes saw the sun as the giver of life and abundance. HPB says, by Dionysus or Bacchus, according to the highest conception of this deity, we understand the spiritual part of the mundane soul. For there are various processions or avatars of this gods or Bacchuses derived from his essence. So this is very much connected to the male aspect of Mother Nature, the celebration of this solar life. Came through these particular gods. Then we have the golden fleece of Jason was the symbol of the causal body. The many adventures undergone while seeking the fleece aligns him with the labors of Hercules. He too was a half god, half man seeker of the experience of deity. As to Zeus, HPB, quoting Hermes, says, the supreme being of heaven, or of all that is comprehended under this name, is Zeus. For it is by heaven that Zeus gives life to all things. The supreme being of the sun is light. For it is by the disk of the sun that we receive the benefit of light. There's also a very Uranian aspect to the thunderbolt connected with Zeus. And as to Uranus, we know from DK that it is the final synthesizing planet, merging with the sun as the last act of this, our current solar incarnation. There's an interesting footnote in first volume of The Secret Doctrine, quoting Ragon's Maçonnerie Occulte, suggesting that the ancients knew of the intrinsic unity of Uranus and the sun. And remember, Uranus hadn't been discovered yet, but they were, on an esoteric level, they were aware of this planet. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
The Secret Doctrine teaches that the sun is a central star and not a planet. Yet the ancients knew of and worshipped seven great gods, excluding the sun and earth. Which was that mystery of God that they set apart? Of course, not Uranus, discovered only by Herschel in 1781. But could it not be known by another name, says the author of Maçonnerie Occulte? Occult sciences, having discovered through astronomical calculations that the number of the planets must be seven, the ancients were led to introduce the sun into the scale of the celestial harmonies and make him occupy the vacant place. Thus, every time they perceived an influence that pertained to none of the six planets known, they attributed it to the sun. The error only seems important, but was not so in practical results. If the ancient astrologers replaced Uranus by the sun, which is a central star relatively motionless, turning only on its axis and regulating time and measure, and which cannot be turned aside from its true functions. The nomenclature of the days of the week is thus faulty. The sun day ought to be Uranus day, Urani dies, Urandi, adds the learned writer Ragon.
Interesting. So, suggesting that very possibly, the at occult levels, certainly the hierarchy, knew of Uranus's existence, and the sun was a blind inserted for the planet Uranus. And finally, DK tells us that Vulcan is one with the sun. Gerald, this concludes the list that MPH gives of planets that are and deities that are connected with the sun. Gerald Massey gives us more insight on this. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. And Veronica, can you read that, please?
Yes. Hello.
Hi, Veronica.
The first divinity of fire and light was in a sense pre-solar. He began as an elementary or an element before the sun was a timekeeper and before it was known by the same sun that set and rose again. For illustration, Teth is an Egyptian solar god and yet not the sun itself in the later sense, but as a form of the Egyptian Vulcan or Hephaestus, he is a god of fire because the element was first and the fire or light was primary, whether the fire of the sun or the lightning flash or the conflagration as one of the elementaries. So was it in India. The Natural Genesis, Volume 1.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. And don't go anywhere because I have a quote that's full of Greek names coming up, and it would be terrific if you could read that for us.
Okay.
Okay, great. Any thoughts or questions about this list? So next up, the Norwegians.
Francis?
Yeah.
I just want to say my thoughts when we went through that list was the many times that DK tells us the sun is veiling a planet, and those planets that he specifically tells us over and over again are Vulcan, Uranus, and Neptune. So putting it all together in my little pea brain, you know, it all seems to fit this ancient way of looking at things.
Yeah, I agree. There's definitely a connection there, isn't there? With Uranus, for instance, the hierarchical ruler of Leo is the sun veiling Uranus, you know. So just what does that mean? Well, it certainly speaks to their essential unity, and, you know, which is, I think, very much relevant to what we were just reading.
And then we have a comment from Magda. She says, future Vulcan is called the seventh and final incarnation of Earth.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, you Magda, appreciate your unusual, different perspective on these teachings, whenever you bring them forth. Thank you.
Yes, in anthroposophy, it's called the seventh incarnation of Earth, the final one in this Manvantara. And so I was thinking, it's like the final one, so it's the maximum etherization, angelication of Earth. Now we're on the fourth round, right? So, fifth is future Zeus, Jove, how do you say in English? Jupiter. Future Jupiter is the next round. Then there is future Venus, and then up back to future Vulcanus. That's how it is in anthroposophy. So it's the final one where we have the maximum, it's the final target before we close up with a big dark, with a big pralaya phase.
Yeah, okay. Now, to translate that into theosophy, the rounds and the chains, as well as the globes, have an association with one of the seven sacred planets. And this is often done according to Ray, not necessarily sequentially, but it can through the rays, but it can be. And so it would make sense that the final cycle, whether you look at it as a globe, a round, or a chain, the final cycle would be oriented to the first ray, because that prepares one for pralaya and dissipation. And so, you know, whether it's, you know, it's not, you know, Vulcan has its own scheme and therefore its own series of chains and rounds and globes. But there's a deep association between the sacred planets and with each other in terms of their influence. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, anyone else? I see. Okay. So next up, the Norwegians regarded Balder the Beautiful as a solar deity, and Udan is often connected with the celestial orb, especially because of his one eye. In his dissertation on the mysteries of the Kabiri, Faber tells us, in allusion to solar devotion, Udan is said to have been the father of Balder, or Baal Adair, the illustrious Baal, whose eyes were so piercing that they seemed to dart forth rays of light. Another author simply says, Balder is Mithras, or Mithras, the sun's love. Next, among the Egyptians, Osiris, Ra, Anubis, Hermes, and even the mysterious Amon himself had points of resemblance with the solar disk. So his list continues. He's basically, you know, laying out a whole bunch of the ancient civilizations' solar deities. So just as Vulcan represents the primordial, unmanifest fire of the sun, Osiris represents solar vitality. The Egyptian Book of the Dead states, I shall not be turned back in the horizon, for I am Ra Osiris. The point of that quote being his identification with the sun. Gerald Massey describes Anubis's connection with the sun. Can we get a reader, please?
Okay, James has his hand up. So James, go ahead and ask your question, and then if you will read, please.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, could you go back to the book with the Kabiri?
Sure.
Yeah, I've never seen that. So briefly, what are the Kabiri?
Well, the Kabiri were the great gods of the they began in terms of the name, they're most associated with the Phoenician deific hierarchy. Even though, you know, Samothrace is the oldest school in Greece in terms of the mysteries, and it's believed to have been much influenced by the Phoenician. So it would be similar to the original, the seven who emanate from the one, the great seven sources of differentiation of the one God, right? Yeah, that's really all I could say.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. You need to go to the next so he can read.
Okay, this?
Yeah.
Plutarch suggested that the horizon immediately before the rising and immediately after the setting of the sun was symbolized by Anubis. Renouf says, I believe that he represents the twilight or dusk immediately following the disappearance of the sun. But Anubis is the guide of ways, the guide of Isis and of Sothis, the discoverer of the sun, the conductor of souls. He was typified by the jackal that came out at dusk and was painted with a black head as a guide of Western land, and the jackal was the golden dog as the guide to the horizon of the resurrection. And when they talk about dogs, is that serious?
Well, the association is certainly there. You know, Isis or Sothis was believed to be a personification of Sirius. And if you look at Osiris, I mean, it's right there, isn't it? Osiris and Isis, the names are so much connected with Sirius. So I think the Egyptians recognize, you know, certainly the priesthood, that this is the source of their deity, right?
Also, wasn't it really important to them the certain time of the year when Sirius rose above the horizon? That was like the beginning of their flooding or some season?
Yeah, it was, and I can't speak directly to just what it marked, but you're right, the rising of Sirius was a sacred holiday, and when it first rose, and marked, it very well might have been the beginning of the flood season, but I'm not sure on that.
Yeah, I believe it was the annual flooding of the Nile.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Any thoughts or questions about this? Okay, next. Let's see, where in the heck? So Hermes Trismegistus was the great Egyptian avatar who brought forth the teachings of Pymander. If you remember, we had a whole section on this in the previous chapter, also known as the divine mind. The celestial Hermes is Mercury, of which DK says the following. Can we get a reader, please?
Okay. Hold on just one second. Magda says, by the prophecies given to Pope John Paul XXIII in 1935 by Conchita Seashell, the sun is the eye and the earth was the first created planet. So whatever the names of the deity representing with his relative avatar, semi-god hero, they all are the divine eye looking upon earth, their first creation.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So you could see it's by association in that sense. Interesting. Thank you.
Okay, Magda, can you read this for us, please?
Mercury and sun and the sun are one. Through Mercury, the mind is illumined and relation is established between personality and the soul. As Mercury, the sun, the mediator, shifts to a still higher plane and is no longer mediator between two different stages in consciousness, but between life and consciousness itself. This is very different matter, in effect, the higher understanding. This will necessarily be incomprehensible to you at present, for it is not a mediatorship between differences, but a fusion of what is already related, esoteric astrology 132.
Thank you, Magda. Okay, and finally, G.R.S. Mead uncovers Amon's association with the sun. That was last in the list. Can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Knif, however, is one of the alliances of Amon, who's the bull or husband of his mother, the creator who has created himself. Knef is, moreover, the good diamond, as Philo of Byblos says. He's the sun god and heaven god, Amon. If he open his eyes, he filleth all with light in his primeval land, and if he close them, all is dark. Here we have Knef, Amon, as the giver of light in darkness and the opener of the eyes.
Thank you. Okay. Next, Isis was the mother of the sun. And even Typhon, the destroyer, was supposed to be a form of solar energy. Okay, so Isis was the mother of the sun because she is Mula Prakriti, the source, the shining sea of all substance, undifferentiated, and thus the mother aspect of all life. All forms are drawn from this great sea, even that of the sun. In mythology, Isis is universally worshipped as Mother Nature, or nature in subjection to the sun. In the later Egyptian dynasties, Typhon was seen as all that opposed the sun. But in the earlier dynasties, which often are the more esoteric, he was identified with the Great Bear, very much a first aspect being, hence his destructive nature, which is source of spirit to our solar system. Thus, darkness as the source of light, rather than the darkness of ignorance and evil with which he later became associated. This is one of those fallen angel type beings. Next, the Egyptian sun myth finally centered around the persons of a mysterious deity called Serapis. Earlier in the series, we took a look at an entire segment on the Alexandrian Serapis, known in Egypt as Esar-Hapi. In that subsection, MPH describes Serapis as symbolizing the soul of the world, or anima mundi. Quote, the material body of nature was called Apis, the name for the sacred bull of ancient Egypt. The soul, which escaped from the body at death, but was enmeshed with the form during physical life, was designated Serapis. Here's an artist's conception of the Serapium in Alexandria. So it was really soul worship, but that soul which was enmeshed in the form aspect. This, the ancients really put a lot of emphasis on this aspect. For instance, the whole mythology of Persephone and Hades was wrapped around this. How does Persephone get out of quote-unquote hell, which is physical incarnation? Okay. Next, the two Central American deities, Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl, while often associated with the winds, were also undoubtedly solar gods. So Quetzalcoatl, the great South American avatar, was a solar god in the same way that Hercules, the Christ, and Hermes were solar gods. He was high priest. He was an actual living person, and was, as was Hercules for that matter. He was high priest of Tula, which means city of the sun. That's another association with the solar god. Can we get a reader for this, please?
Yes, Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. And so we are not surprised to learn that the great high priest and monarch of the Golden Age in the Toltec city of Tula, the city of the sun in ancient Mexico, whose name Quetzalcoatl has been read to mean both the feathered serpent and the admirable twin, and who was fair of face and white of beard, was the teacher of the arts of the people of pre-Columbian America, originator of the calendar, and their giver of maize. This virgin mother, Chimalaman, the legend tells, has been one of the three sisters to whom God, the All-Father, had appeared one day under his form of Citlaltonac, the morning. The other two had been struck by fright, but upon Chimamalama, God breathed and conceived her, and she conceived. She died, however, giving birth, and is now in heaven, where she is revered under the honorable name of the precious stone of sacrifice, Chalachichulzitli. Quetzalcoatl, her child, who is known both as the son of the Lord of the High Heavens and as the son of the Lord of the Seven Caves, was endowed at birth with speech, all knowledge, and all wisdom, and in later life, as priest-king, was of such purity of character that his realm flourished gloriously throughout the period of his reign. His temple palace was composed of four radiant apartments, one toward the east, yellow with gold, one towards the west, blue with turquoise and jade, one towards the south, white with pearls and shells, one toward the north, red with bloodstones, symbolizing the cardinal quarters of the world over which the light of the sun holds sway.
Thank you, Scott. We would have had a Mayan student read this, but we're a little short on those just now.
Murdered those words.
No, you didn't. You did fine. I always try to sound them out before these webinars so that, I don't fall on my face with them. But they're just so foreign to, our English way of working through the anatomy of a word. Anyway, the other Central American deity, Tezcatlipoca, succeeded Quetzalcoatl and was high priest when the Spanish arrived in 1519. So both of these quote-unquote sun gods were living solar priests. Especially Quetzalcoatl was a Christ-like figure, really, avatar for that of that time, in that part of the world. Next. In masonry, the sun has many symbols. One expression of the solar energy is Solomon, whose name, Sol, Om, On, is the name of the supreme light in three different languages. So there are four main symbols for the sun in masonry. Correct me if I'm wrong, you masons out there. First, the blazing star, depicting as a five-pointed star representing the sun as the source of light and life. Second, the square and compass, arguably the most universal symbol of masonry, represent the tools of the operative mason who built the temples and cathedrals of the past. And according to various Masonic sources, they also symbolize the moral and spiritual principles of the speculative Masons who seek, in other words, speculative Masons means those who take masonry as a form of philosophy and who seek to build the inner temple. The square is a symbol of mortality, justice, and honesty, while the compasses are a sign of wisdom, moderation, and self-control. Together, they form a right angle that points to the sun at its meridian, which signifies the highest point of perfection that a Mason can attain. More esoterically, the compass represents the creative aspect of deity, and the square represents the form aspect through which deity manifests. And third, the letter G, often but not always placed in the center of the square and compass, represents, among other things, the sun as the generative force of nature. More esoterically, G is the note of the second ray and is thus the sound that brought our solar system into manifestation. And finally, the sun itself, depicted as either a radiant disk or a human face with rays emanating from it, represents the physical sun that illuminates the world, as well as the spiritual sun that enlightens the mind. Often, these symbols are shown in combination. So before I get to your question, Ariane, you Masons out there, or is there anything you'd like to add or correct me on in terms of the that very brief thumbnail sketch of the Masonic symbols.
Scott?
Yeah, Scott.
I just want to say that that was a fabulous rundown.
Okay.
Of the square and compasses. That should be printed out and given to every lodge because they have not a clue about that range. Of that.
Yeah, that always surprised me. He's talking about the square here, you see, and then the compass. I'm a master mason, as is Scott, and what we've both discovered is that for the most part, this is not universally true, but there's not all that much interest in the philosophy behind masonry and the occult side of it. It's a terrific surface organization often. I was a member in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there were many members who did a lot of community outreach and that type of service, but there was very little interest in the kinds of things we're talking about here. But that doesn't mean that this philosophy doesn't exist. The lodge that I was in had quite a large library, and it was full of very esoteric information. Anyway, yeah, thanks, Scott. Okay.
Okay, and then we have one more on this. And Veronica says, "I was thinking about the square and the compass."
Yeah. And.
Benita, I haven't finished my thought, and it came out half. I was thinking about this, the square and the compass. That this the compass is spirit and God that subscribes all. It subscribes matter.
Absolutely, that's my understanding too. You know, if you're gonna translate it into geometry, it'd be the triangle and the square, obviously. So you would have the numeral source of the material reality. But you know, the way they're often portrayed, you have the compass really the dominant factor. So that would be the nature of, for instance, an initiate, where the numeral or the compass aspect would control the form aspect. You know, and of course you got to think, I didn't put it in here and I really should have, is Blake's famous painting, you know, of the God, you know, you all know this, he's stooping down and he's got a compass and he's the Lord of creation at that moment. I wish I'd have put it in here, but I didn't. Thank you, Veronica. Okay.
Okay, we have... now to Ariana.
Ariana here, yeah. I was looking for that painting by Blake because I have it somewhere amongst my papers. And he's sort of like a Herculean figure, naked, leaning over this and drawing. But the thing I wanted to comment on was earlier on when you talked about Quetzalcoatl, could you go back to that picture? And I'm sorry if I'm...
No, no problem at all. You know, I love this. You know, when you all get engaged... That's the best, you know. So here's Quetzalcoatl.
Okay. Can you hear me? So yeah. The comment that I wanted to make was that according to, you know, the group that I work with, with the Ageless Wisdom Teachings, the history is that Jesus did come and appear before the Mayans. He himself came. And if you look at the other drawing, he's the God is a very pale skin. So he appeared. And then, unfortunately, when the Spanish and Portuguese materialist explorers came later, including Columbus and all those people who came with their armadas, they were initially welcomed and misconstrued as the Jesus of lore from the sixth century who had previously visited. And so that's what allowed for that you know, miscalculation. It's interesting in this picture, it almost looks like he's wearing a lock or something. What is that around his wrist? Do you know?
No, I don't. You know, unfortunately, this is a survey course. And yeah, you're talking about this. I doubt it's a lock. You just have to get into doing things like counting these things, which are, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's the number of manifestation. And then you have the unity in manifestation. You also have a duality here between the, you know, the top of this, you know, that's all we can do. And unless you get to an informed esoteric source, which can be difficult to find on this kind of stuff.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. I would go with, rather than any kind of literalist interpretation of the colors here, as representative of energies. You know, so for instance, off the top, given our theosophical orientation, the yellow could represent a Mercurian, which, you know, is the messenger of the gods idea, which is exactly what these priests were. So I see another hand.
Yes, and we have a comment from Magda. She says the square and compass as lingam and yoni, or as spirit and matter / form.
Excellent. Yeah, that, you know, they represent that fundamental duality of spirit and form in a particular orientation. You know, their interaction is very defined. And another hand, or is that it?
I was just going to mention on the picture of Quetzalcoatl it's a forward and backwards motion. And for me, when I look at that, I also think of Saturn and timing and the relevance of something coming into form and relinquishing form. And for me, that depiction actually kind of holds that presence. And so I just really wanted to mention that piece.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for that. You know, I would love to read a treatise by an esotericist. You know, like, wouldn't you love to have DK's interpretation of this picture? You know, I bet he could tell you a lot about what all these symbols mean, because the Mayans were just, you know, rife with these wonderful symbols of energetic symbols. Okay, anybody else?
Yes, Magda says, regarding Quetzalcoatl, can we therefore talk not only of fallen angels, but also of fallen deities?
Well, Quetzalcoatl lived, and so he would be like an avatar, a Christ-like figure. And so from one point of view, you can call that a fallen deity, but I think it's more in the realm of an overshadowed human being, certainly overshadowed by deity as Jesus was by Christ. And, you know, it would just be fascinating to know the more about Quetzalcoatl from that esoteric viewpoint, and not just from a historical viewpoint. You know, he doesn't get much press in the West. You know, I mean, we're all about Jesus, we're all about the Buddha, but, you know, you don't usually find Quetzalcoatl in this, also mentioned along those lines. And I think he really was a real solar deity, meaning a son of God. Anyone else? Fascinating stuff. We actually did a full webinar sometime back on this material. Okay. All right, I'll go back forward again. All right, so next up, in masonry, the sun has many symbols. One expression of the solar energy is Solomon, whose name Sol, Om, On, is the name of the supreme light in three different languages. There are four main symbols for the sun, and oh, I did this. Sorry, I did that. Okay, so interesting comment on the, so we're up to there, sorry. So interesting comment on the etymology of Solomon. Sol is Latin for sun. We find the connection of Om with the sun in the Upanishads. Quote, the immortal formless is truth. The truth is the Brahman. The Brahman is the light. The light is the sun, which is the syllable Om as the self. The world is Om. Its light is sun. And the sun is also the light of the syllable Om. I really love this. The circular causality is just really cool. And finally, the last two letters of Solomon, O-N, was actually the name of the sun in ancient Egypt. Next up, Hiram Abiff, I don't know, this CH, this C, Hiram, is just, as far as I know, that's just pronounced Hiram or Hiram of the Chaldees, is also a solar deity. And the story of his attack and murder by the ruffians with its solar interpretation will be found in the chapter, The Hiramic Legend. Okay, MPH dedicates an entire chapter to the Hiramic Legend, beginning on page 77 of the folio edition. So, that's a number of pages in the folio edition that he gives to this. I was surprised to find. You may remember this illustration of the death of Hiram Abiff from a previous webinar. Here you can see the ruffians going after Hiram, and then this is the death of Hiram here. I see a hand.
Yes, James, yes, go ahead.
The pronunciation, I'm thinking if it's related to Hebrew, the CH is a H sound.
Like Hiram. Hiram.
Yeah, chutzpah.
Yeah, right.
So Hiram.
Yeah. If it's meant to be, since they're both capitalized, I'm not sure that it's meant to be pronounced as a single word. It may be more of a symbol. I just don't know. Some Masonic writers have suggested that the legend of Hiram Abiff is an allegory of the sun's journey through the zodiac. Let's see. I read this. The Setting Mall. Hiram Abiff represents the sun, the source of light and life. The three ruffians represent the three winter months during which the sun is lessened. It's just one. Sounds to me like an exoteric interpretation. The Setting Mall, it's a particular kind of mall that sets the level, and the Plum Rule represent the signs of Scorpio, Capricorn, and Aquarius. The sprig of acacia represents the sign of Pisces. These are all symbols in masonry. The last sign before the spring equinox. The resurrection of Hiram Abiff represents the rebirth of the sun in the sign Aries, which marks the beginning of a new cycle. So, I think even that is ultimately a blind, but at least it's one layer deeper. And finally, a striking example of the important part which the sun plays in the symbols and rituals of Freemasonry is given by George Oliver D.D. I'm not sure what D.D. stands for. Doctor of Dentistry? No, something. In his Dictionary of Symbolical Masonry as follows. So here's an engraving of George Oliver along with the title page of his dictionary. Anybody know what DD means? Okay.
No.
Doctor of Divinity. Thank you. And we're not talking about the candy. Yeah. That's what it is. Thanks, Scott. So let's continue, because this is where this is the so this is the striking example of the important part of which the sun plays in the symbols and rituals of Freemasonry. This. So could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The sun rises in the east, and in the east is the place for the worshipful master. As the sun is the source of all light and warmth, so should the worshipful master enliven and warm the brethren to their work. Among the ancient Egyptians, the sun was the symbol of divine providence. The hierophants of the mysteries were adorned with many insignia emblematic of solar power. The sunbursts of gilt embroidery on the back of the vestments of the Catholic priesthood signify that the priest is also an emissary and representative of Sol Invictus.
Thank you. Okay, so first, the sun rises in the east, and in the east is the place for the worshipful master. As the sun is the source of all light and warmth, so should be the worshipful master. No, so should the worshipful master enliven and warm the brethren to their work. Here's a map of a Masonic lodge showing the seat of the worshipful master in the east. And here's a photo of the worshipful master and brethren in a London lodge, probably the main London lodge. Most lodges are much simpler than this. Only a few lodges in the world's biggest cities are going to be this grand. Next, among the ancient Egyptians, the sun was the symbol of divine providence. Okay, so divine providence literally means, I had to look it up because I wanted to see just what it meant. It means under God's sovereign guidance and control. The sun was seen as a symbol of guidance in ancient Egypt because it was believed to be the highest manifestation of the supreme unmanifest, that would be Ra, because only manifest deity can, quote unquote, guide and control. The appearance and nature of that guidance comes through various permutations of the solar deity, as we looked at before, right? Recognized in ancient Egypt as gods and goddesses in their own right, as shown in this left column, though the philosophers and the priest class would have also known all their gods as aspects of the one solar life. Okay. The great Platonist Thomas Taylor explores the idea of combining the influence of various gods and goddesses in his book, wonderful book, The Mystical Hymns of Orpheus, referencing the planets. He states, "For from this sublime theory, it follows that every sphere, meaning every planet, contains every deity, each sphere at the same time conferring on these gods the peculiar characteristic of its nature. So that, for instance, in the sun, they all possess a solar property, in the moon, a lunar one, and so of the rest." I love this. I think it's a really enlightened way of of exploring the philosophy of deity. Really marvelous, but not surprising. Thomas Taylor was a really enlightened human being and author. Next, the Hierophants of the Mysteries were adorned with many insignia emblematic of solar power. This illustration shows Sybil, her here called the Syrian goddess, in the robes of a Hierophant. Montfaucon describes this figure. Could we get a reader, please?
Heidi, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Upon her head is the Episcopal mitre, adorned on the lower part with towers and pinnacles. Over the gate of the city is a crescent, and beneath the circuit of walls, a crown of rays. The goddess wears a sort of surplice exactly like the surplice of a priest or bishop, and upon the surplice a tunic which falls down to the legs, and over all an episcopal cope with 12 signs of the zodiac wrought on borders. The figure hath a lion on each side and holds in its left hand tympanum, a sistrum, a distaff, and a caduceus, and another instrument in her right hand. She holds with her middle finger a thunderbolt, and upon the same arm, must be.
I didn't proofread this. That's R. Same. Yeah. R animal.
Animals, insects, and as far as we may guess, flowers, fruits, a bow, a quiver, a torch, a scythe. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. So the whereabouts of the statue, if it ever existed, is unknown. The copy reproduced here by Montfaucon is from a drawing by Piero Ligorio. Next, the sunbursts of gilt embroidery on the back of the vestments of the Catholic priesthood signify that the priest is also an emissary and representative of Sol Invictus. So, you know, MPH is giving us a grand tour of all these ways in which the sun has pervaded the spiritual belief systems of the ancients, as well as in including the Catholic priesthood. Sol Invictus was the Roman unconquered supreme god, and it was in the late Roman Empire that Christianity became the state religion. So here are a couple of examples of, quote, sunburst of gilt embroidery on the back of the vestments of the Catholic priesthood. It's interesting, you know, the nature of the rays that are shown here. I'm just noticing this for the first time. It's exactly the same as on the tarot card of the sun, which is the 19th arcanum. I see a hand.
Yes, thanks. Speaking of tarot, the Hierophant, I've always wondered what it meant. It looks like a bishop or a pope or a higher up, but is there an exact meaning? Do we know?
Oh, well, that's a big question. You know, first of all, the thing you look at is its number, which is 5.
I only ask big questions.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you, yeah. So its number 5 puts it in the position that is in that place of the second aspect, you know, the fifth plane is the mental plane. The star is that which adds to or overshadows the square, which is the fourfold, right? So it's that nature of the consciousness of that. Also, you know, you have Venus as the fifth ray, and it has many associations with the number five. So it would be that quality that is able to be the messenger of the gods. So I don't think it's specifically, I'm trying to remember if there was a planet associated with the Hierophant. If somebody wants to do a little side research and then pull it up, you know, one good source is Paul Foster Case's The Tarot, you know, find out what he would have to say on about this. This card would be that's the first place I would go on this. I could pull it out of the bookshelf, but I think we'll not do that. But if somebody wants to do a little research, they could. Okay. Not a fully sufficient answer, I realize. Okay. Next up, can we get a reader? Yeah, Scott. Are you muted? You're muted. Yeah.
Can you back a slide?
Yeah.
That one. The vestment on the right. Whenever I see it, I think of two symbols there. One is the Neptune symbol.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Which Christ is located. And certainly Neptune is one of his planets, so to speak. Its relationship is true through Pisces and elsewhere. And I also see it as that downward pointing dove, which is the symbol of the descending soul into form originally. And I see those two. The other one is, it's so red. Henry, yeah. Anyway, I think of those two and when I think of that vestment quote.
Right. Yeah. I think the one on the right here is the more esoteric in that way. And right, this also the third aspect, the third ray, you know, this quality of the bringing down the influence of Christ into the form aspect. Yeah. These looks like little cherubim here, doesn't it? Seraphim or cherubim. Very interesting robe. I see another hand.
Yes, Heidi, go ahead.
I was just going to add to, I also agree with the energy that is being brought down, but I also see it being brought up as a birthing energy. And then on the left-hand side in that robe, I see the sun, but it's shaped, it's in more of a womb-like, you know, or a cup, you could say. Mm-hmm. It's being held in a cup. And then above it is what appears to be a flower, like a blossoming of something.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah,
or, an emergence of something. So yeah. I almost see the two of them being complementary. One referencing more of the form and the other one referencing more of the formless or the outer personality uh-huh. that begins to flower and the inner essence that is present. And for me, the six cherubs or seraphim represent the number six, which is the ideation of something and to bring that ideation into formation. So anyway, that's that.
Very good. I like that. Yeah, it brought up a couple of things for me. You were just talking about the Hierophant. Well, looky here, we got five petals with this central point, you know, so that would very much relate, you know, to the five of the Hierophant. Also, Isn't the Rosicrucian rose, I think it's a five-petaled rose as well. So there's, you know, there is a quality of the number five that definitely has to do with the second aspect. You know, for instance, Venus has, you know, a second-ray personality, a second and sixth-ray monad, at least it's speculated, and a fifth-ray soul. And so there's very, and of course, Venus is very much connected with the second aspect. You know, it's a, you could say, the source of soul on our planet, right? But yeah, thank you for these ideas. Also, I'm seeing the Vesica Pisces here, which, you know, if you have the two overlapping circles, you have on one side pure deity, unmanifest, and on the other, the pure form world, which is represented by Isis and Mula Prakriti, right? And then the overlapping section is the, you know, the father, the mother, and the son comes through the overlapping. And, you know, for instance, over the main doorway in Chartres Cathedral, you have this, the Christ appearing in a Vesica Pisces like this, stepping forth from, you could say, the unseen realm. And you have that again here. So yeah, I see many hands.
Francis, we have hands, we have comments, but I would like to point out that on the left one, you know, that reminds me of Leo. The symbolism of the crown, the symbolism of the sun, the symbolism of the red for ray one, and the fleur-de-lis there in the, I mean, to me just screams the sun, S-U-N, and the sun, S-O-N.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I just wanted to point that out. Okay. Let me see if I find all these right. Magda says, Mother of God, Mother of Syria, meaning Mother of the planet. Sirius is the planet from which God comes from. That's a question.
Oh, well, it is to our solar logos what the soul is to the personality. So you could certainly look at it as an aspect of the Godhead. Yeah, it's not
a planet, though. It's a star.
It's a star. It's a system. Just like the solar logos is, it's a superior logoic system to our solar logos.
Okay, and then James says, from Google for the Hierophant, Venus, Taurus, and love. And then question mark, exoteric, he says.
Well, you know, Venus is ruler of Taurus, so you have that aspect of it, you know, and it's where you find Venus as the esoteric ruler, you have that same expression lifted up into the level of the soul connection. Yeah, all of that relates to this connection between the two and the five and the higher aspect of this fifth ray energy. You know, actually, if you look into the fifth ray, you know, it's not just concrete science. It's the synthetic ray that allows the personality to achieve soul union. So in that way, you could see it's inextricable connection with the soul aspect.
And then a couple of more comments that mirror what was said there. Charlie says the Hierophant is related to Taurus. And James said, put in the picture, the Rosicrucian rose, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, it's got five outer petals and five inner petals and then one center core. So the picture's there in the chat. Helios Soul Voice says the Hierophant is in Egypt is the high initiated priest.
Yeah, everybody click on their chat box and take a look at this illustration of the the lotus or rose, and you can see it, it's like a detail of what we're seeing in the upper part of this robe. It's pretty cool. Thanks for including that. It's great.
And then a couple of things about Sirius being a star, and it's a binary system with a larger and smaller star that rotate around each other. So
actually, as I understand it, okay, it's ternary. It's actually three stars they've discovered. And there's some interesting.
Okay, we have.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say we have hands up, but go ahead. Finish, please.
No. I was just going to say there's the Dagones, who are a tribe that is to the west of Egypt. Even in ancient times, they recognized Sirius B. They, in their early illustrations, they have pictures of Sirius with a star rotating around it. Well, you cannot see Sirius B with the naked eye, you know? And so obviously they were privy to some esoteric information that informed their particular spiritual study. Okay, let's go ahead with the questions.
Scott, please go ahead.
Oh, just along that line, the Dagon people in Mali, in their dance and their descriptions, their drawings, they show Sirius C as well.
Even really? Wow, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's yes. They got their information from the East, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's just looking at the two robes here, it's clear to me that's totally sixth ray. You have the Martian one, you have the Neptunian one.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. And of course, Catholicism, the church is first and third ray, but Christianity is a sixth ray religion.
And that's the red of Mars there versus
absolutely. That's very good. Yeah.
Maria says the robe on the left has an alien face in the center.
Robe on the left has an Aryan face in the center?
Alien.
Oh, alien. You mean this IHR? It's not what that stands for. I think it is. I don't see it.
She says a lion. She says lion. So maybe it was a typo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's in just a little more pale red. I see it there under the middle crown. Is that what you're talking about?
Here. Are you talking about here?
Below that. There's that in the pale red, you can actually see a lion's face, it looks like to me. She says below the middle crown. Yeah.
Below the middle crown. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll take your word for it.
I see it too. I see it too. It's in a little lighter.
Okay, cool.
Paler red than the normal red, but.
Hey, hang on a sec. All right. I don't normally do this, but you know, why not? We're looking in here, right?
Up above that.
Above that. So in this section.
Right there. Yeah.
Oh, in the lighter red. Maria, you have good sight. I can see what you're seeing. Yeah, interesting. Of course, that goes along with the Leo idea. In the crown and the king and the red and the first ray and all that.
Right. Right. And that's what Heliosolvos says as well. Definitely has the energy of the Leo constellation.
Okay. Interesting.
So we all feel that. Okay. Heidi.
I had one other thing that I wanted to add, which
go ahead.
Was the, so you have the solar rays coming out on the left-hand side, but inside of that, you have what looks to me and the way that I would look at it, is a breath. So like what's breathing the flame, and that's in the up and down of the inspiration and expiration. And then when I look at those four figures in the center, I actually see them as the four elements that are actually being held and contained within the breath and held and protected by the sun of Sirius. And then there's more, but I can't quite put it into words, but I definitely see it as a more living, vibratory aspect. And and what I do know about Leo and the star Sirius, the star system Sirius, it actually is deeply connected to the water systems of the planet, of the space that actually creates itself out of nothing and into something and then has to recycle itself. It recycles itself through that knowledge of water, and that comes through the star system Sirius. And interesting to me is the fact that the star system Sirius was mapped prior to now, but is resurfacing its knowledge for us at this time. And so that's the end of what I have to say. Thank you.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, the ideas of the cosmic waters, you know, out of which the manifested solar system arose, you know, it's connected with a cosmic astral plane as well. Interesting comments, guys. I didn't myself look as closely at these two robes as we have now together, so I appreciate that.
We have a couple of more comments. Helios Soul Voice says, Regulus in particularly, as it's the spiritual royalty. Regulus, you know, of Leo, has the same root as the word Rex. And then she goes on to say, also appears as each robe reflects the spiritual makeup of the bishop, archbishop, who was wearing it, as each robe was handmade for each servant of God.
Interesting. That's a whole other side to this, you know, the nature of the one wearing these. And, you know, I'm sure it wasn't a local priest that we get to wear such robes as these. It would be cardinals. Yeah. And I see another hand, two more hands.
Yeah, we got two. James, go ahead.
Any thoughts about the robe on the left? Under the crown is a symbol that looks like a P or a reverse Jupiter's symbol and the two dots.
Yeah, let me enlarge it again and see if we can figure that out, because I was drawn to that as well. My guess is that this symbol represents the Christ, but I'm not familiar with it. Is anybody here? It is a P because you see this arm on top. Otherwise, it looks like a reversed Jupiter 4, but I think it is anybody?
Maybe something in Latin, since it's of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, maybe. Or a symbol for
Pater, Patriarch.
I'm seeing that maybe Margarita Batelli is going to tell us.
Helios Soul Voice says P for Peter.
Oh, yeah. And of course, the priest is the representative of Peter. Peter is the archetype of every cardinal and priest, you know, the rock of the church, the one that grounds the teachings for the congregation. So that's a possibility, right? And good idea. Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Biel.
Yeah, let's go ahead we still have a couple more comments, but go ahead, Scott, please.
It's interesting. Does anybody know, are these two robes worn at the same time by an archbishop?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I don't even think they're from the same time period. I chose them out of, you know, if you if you just Google Catholic robes, you know, and just keep looking, you know, I chose these two out of a, you know, maybe a dozen or so that, you know, were possible candidates. So I doubt that they would have come together.
Does the Archbishop
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to ask, does anybody know what, does the Archbishop or the Pope wear a double robe, a double, something like this?
Oh, you're out of my pay grade. I don't really know. My understanding is it's one robe over a white inner robe. But gosh, I just don't know. Maybe there's Catholics here that or have some Catholic background that might know that. I don't know.
They're from a Gucci line of Pope wear.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Francis, can you make the robe on the right bigger? Vivian says the angels are bearing banners with writing. Can they be read?
No, they cannot. That'd be nice. But as you can see, it's just not enough resolution here. You know, I don't know. I can't read it anyway. This one, it seems like it almost could be Deo, maybe at the end. Yeah, my guess is that they're common Catholic terms.
What could help is if you played around with the colors, like black and white, or the brightness and contrast sometimes will really bring out the letters.
Yeah, I could take this into Photoshop and maybe do it. If you guys have 30 minutes, I could probably pull it out for you, but not in a minute. You know, and besides that, we're out of time. So this was a let's go with the rest of the comments and hands, and that'll be it.
Okay. Heidi says, thank you. The remembrance on this is very important for this moment and revealing itself through each of us. Very grateful to be part of this expression of the sacred. Charlie says the two figures kneeling. Charlie says the two figures kneeling on the Hierophant card wears red with roses on left and white with lilies on the right.
Okay, thank you.
Heliosolvoy says, I'm having the impression that the robe on the right belongs to the Orthodox Christianity.
I think they both do. I think they're both.
Charlie says one, the heart. Yeah, I think they're, yeah. Charlie says the one heart red, the other symbol of the mind.
I like that. Third ray, mind.
Magda, Magda, robe red, priest wears it on Christmas, white robe during Saints Day, purple robe, funerals and Easter. Heliosolvoy says, I was born in a country of such religion, even it was suppressed but restored later. Heidi says there are 13 rays on the seraphim, which is the four elements. Magda says light blue robe during Maria's festivities. Scott says white and red roses and Pharaoh's crown. And then Marguerite has patiently had her hand up for a while. So let's finish with Marguerite.
Hi, this is from Paul Foster Case, going back to the Hierophant.
Yeah.
It's a quote. It means revealer of sacred things. It was the name of the chief officer in the Eleusinian mysteries, and signifies that which makes known the hidden import of appearances whereby we are surrounded. In many versions of tarot, this key is named the Pope. And going back to Paul Foster Case being a member of the Golden Dawn, the major arcanum of the tarot is assigned, each one is assigned to a different path on the tree.
Right.
The Hierophant goes from Chokhmah, which is the second Sephira, to Hesed, which is the fourth Sephira, And Paul Foster Kay says about that, if I can find it. Yes, the Sphere of Wisdom, which is number two, is also known as Ab, the Father. It becomes evident that the Hierophant, as an expression of that Sephira's outflowing energy, is not altogether misnamed when it is called the Pope, because it runs from wisdom, number two, to knowledge, wisdom to mercy, excuse me, Hesed is mercy. And he has a tremendous essay on it.
It's my favorite book on the Tarot. It's a relatively small book. Paul Foster Kay, he uses the BOTA, BOTA Tarot. It's really good stuff. And everything you said there, you know, holds with the idea of these being representative of the Hierophant, you know, whichever that path is from the Trinity into the manifest, you know, and that would be definitely the role of a cardinal, priest, or the Pope. So, and with that, any last thoughts, questions, chats before we pull the plug today? Real good session. I appreciate, I really do appreciate the interchange. It's just so much more interesting than me sitting here, you know, just lecturing at you for an hour and a half. So, thanks for that.
Helios Soul Voice says, can you type up this very interesting piece somehow? Book title and author, please. For the book title and author, please, are you referring to, what is it, Paul Somebody Case and his book?
Okay. The Tarot, name of the book, Paul Foster Case, C-A-S-E, very simple.
It has a subtitle, A Key to the Wisdom of the Ages.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a goodie. If you have any, it's my first book. I have probably 20 books on the Tarot. Mostly I just look at Paul Foster Case these days because he tends to epitomize
the. Isn't there a transcript of today instead of having to type it up?
I wouldn't be typing up. I promise you that.
We can get a transcript.
Did you do AI companion?
I did the AI companion, but then we also Zoom automatically does the transcript. The problem with that is Zoom does not speak esoteric. So it takes a really long time to go through and translate what they think the word was versus what the word really was. The best we can do is give you the slides.
I mean, you know, we don't have the time, I certainly don't, to like reinterpret this entire presentation in some kind of typewritten form, you know. That would be lovely, but you know, I can't do that. But what we can do is offer, and you can find them yourself on makara.us. You can get this presentation. The thing to do is just, you know, go through and stop it and listen yourself. You know, and that way you can really you're not swept along by the time by the hour and a half. You can take the time to explore more thoroughly. But beyond the summary, that this kind of an automatic summary given by the Zoom, there's literally a button here that says start summary, you know. And unfortunately, you know, if we were doing on almost any other subject, it would be much more accurate, but it's like BL says, it doesn't speak esoterica. So, you know, it's a lot of misinterpretations, but I've read it. It's not altogether without merit, you know. So anyway, I think that's going to do it. Do we have anybody else? Okay.
Helios Soul Voice wanted to know when the recordings will be up, and I'll have them up within a couple of hours.
And
And James says, yeah, I don't think it's going to type hierophant. No.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see what it thinks that word was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Higher font. Yeah. Okay, you all. Thanks very much.
All right.
And we'll see you next time. Oh, you want to mention
yes. Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah. James says, higher pants. Yeah, we could go on all day with that. The next Treatise on Cosmic Fire is going to be this coming Friday on 8 December. The next Secret Doctrine will be on 17 December. And all of these are at 8 p.m. GMT. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be in the new year. It's going to be on 7 January. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Francis.
Yeah, my pleasure. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.